So this intro today is going to be a little bit longer than usual. I should have a photo and then a video, but we'll see the photo first.
Nice photo.
Not that one. It's pretty though, isn't it? There we go. Anyone recognize what this is?
Johnny Walker.
Well done. That's the brand Johnny Walker. Johnny Walker. So that's the Striding Man. This image is called the Striding Man. And it's key to what we're going to talk about today. And I just want to say as well, we are not here to glorify whiskey or alcohol or even scotch. I love a good scotch. We're not here for that. We're here to glorify Christ. There was an ad campaign maybe in the last 20 years that changed this brand in a big, big way. And the mantra that was attached to this advert that I'm about ready to show you is keep walking. Keep walking. And so if we can, it's 5.5 minutes. We'll watch this together, and then we'll get straight into the text, I promise.
Here's a true story about a young lad named John. Just a local farm boy. There was something special about the lad. A glint in his eye, a fire in his belly, a spring in his step. And one day, he went for a walk. Now this walk began when his father died. The year was 1819, and he was just 14 years old. Bereavement counselling. Well, these were the days when young boys were sent into the fields. The mills, the mines, tough times. But young John was smart enough to be lucky. His father's farm, where he was born and raised, was sold, and the proceeds used to open a grocer's. Big responsibility for the wee lad. His own shop in Kilmarnock, with his name on the door, John Walker. Or Johnny, as the world now knows him. Back then, all grocers stocked a range of local single malts, but they could be a wee bit inconsistent. For John, that wasn't good enough. He began blending different malts together as a way of offering his customers a consistent, unique product. Now this backroom art quickly developed into a commercial proposition, and a very profitable one. And because there's nothing like a commercial proposition to stir the Scottish heart, it grew quickly into an industry filled with ambitious entrepreneur distillers. John thrived in this environment, and so too soon with his sons, Robert and Alexander, who joined him on his journey. The Walkers became the biggest name in a rapidly growing industry. They were unstoppable. In one bold bit of 19th century corporate raiding, they bought the famed distillery at Cardew, lock, stock and ensuring their supply of this silky single malt and guaranteeing, more importantly, that none of the other big blenders could get their hands on it. But young Alexander wasn't content with being Scotland's biggest blender. Not ambitious enough for him. No. He convinced the ship's captains of Glasgow to act as agents for him and drove the whiskey bearing his father's name across the globe. By 1860, he had developed the square bottle. Now, with a label at an angle of precisely 24 degrees. No big deal, you might think, but you'd be wrong. The square bottle meant less breakages and more bottles per shipment. The diagonal label meant larger type, and together, that meant Johnny Walker had unmistakable presence on any shelf in the world. The bottle became an icon, and the rich liquid it contained sought after and consumed across the globe. Quite a character, Alexander Walker. Master of the blender's art. Ambitious. Uncompromising. Mr. Walker. It was John's grandsons, George and Alexander II's turn to join him on his journey. They led the brand into the 20th century. By 1909, they had developed the iconic Red Label and Black Label and persuaded Tom Brown, the best young illustrator of the day, to sketch a striding man in a napkin during a business lunch. In the stroke of a pen, the Victorian grocer was transformed into an Edwardian dandy. By 1920, Johnny's walk had taken him through 120 countries, and he continued walking through the brand's advertising over the next 50 years, into the fabric of global culture, deep into the dark hearts of several wars, to the pleasure palaces of the aristocracy, immortalised by screen legends, celebrated by filmmakers, singers, songwriters, novelists, shoulder to shoulder with the great sportsmen of the age, winning countless international awards for quality, and even being awarded the Royal Wart by King George V. No going back after that. Not that going back would even have occurred to Johnny or any of his family. By the end of the 20th century, the familiar Red Label and Black Label were joined by the Green Label, the Gold Label, and the grandest of them all, Johnny Walker Blue Label. By the beginning of the 21st century, Johnny Walker wasn't just the world's biggest whiskey brand, but an international symbol of progress. The brand's keep walking mantra adopted by pro-democracy protesters and parliamentary speechwriters. What would the farm-born Victorian grocer have thought of all of this? He'd have loved it. A Victorian farm-born grocer he might have been, but he and the family that followed him were possessed by a fiery ambition with the skill and intelligence to match. 200 years later, and Johnny Walker's still walking, and he's not showing any signs of stopping.
One of my favorite adverts of all time because I find it so inspiring. Because in 1999, Johnny Walker was at risk because they were more or less a failing business. After all these decades of success, that striding man on the napkin was facing the wrong direction. Don't know if you remember that, but it was facing left instead of right, into the past instead of the future. And so this particular ad agency basically looked after them and rebranded everything. And they went from potentially not expanding to almost doubling their business over the course of the next 5 years. And now this brand is being sold in 180 different markets. It is one of the best success stories that Scotland has exported to the world, and it's keep walking. I love the message of keep walking, because how much whiskey do you think John Walker would have sold if he hadn't taken every single step as they came, rather than just, well, you think he was going to blend whiskeys in that shop for the rest of his days? I suppose he could have. But knowing that he wanted to achieve something special. And this video talks an awful lot about ambition. He seems like an ambitious guy. But it was about his continued effort to persevere and keep walking. So we're going to mention keep walking as we go. We start off with 2 Kings chapter 4. It's 371 in the Pew Bibles. There's two stories in this chapter, and I've been assigned all 37. Well, actually, no. Just up to 37, but there's two stories that we're going to go through. We'll do them one at a time, if that's okay. The first one's quite short, the second one's quite long. First one's a bit well known, it's the widow's oil. So with your permission, I'll just start reading in chapter 4. Everybody happy with that? The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that he revered the Lord. But now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" "Your servant has nothing there at all," she said, "except a little oil." Elisha said, "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side." She left him, and afterwards shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." But he replied, "There is not a jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. She went and told the man of God and said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debts. You and your sons can live on what is left." I can't imagine the loss that she would be feeling. You know, I walk through the cemetery quite often just to admire some of the big stones and look at the dates. And often you'll find that someone's loved one who passed away even 20 years ago still has fresh flowers sat by it that someone has put there just recently. It can be any time during the week. It can be during the winter. Sometimes I see fresh flowers on these old graves. So if you mourn for 20 years or more about the loss of your loved one, and this has just happened to this woman, just happened, and she's come to Elisha, and she needs his help. And then he says, tell me, how can I help you? What do you have in your house?" He doesn't go with her. He wasn't particularly helpful in her estimation at the time, because she was thinking, "Well, I'm looking for a solution, and you're telling me to go fill up jars and stuff." Her experience must have been so painful. Her experience must have been unjust, because this creditor comes and says, "Now I need your two boys." Can you imagine the kind of person who would do that to a grieving widow? Her experience is that she was empty-handed and so needy. She was desperate. All she had was a little bit of olive oil, just a little bit. Elisha responds with demands, an appeal to have a response. Elisha responded with a challenge to have faith unexpectedly and rewardingly. Elisha asked her to go, to walk, to leave from where she was and go to many people. Elisha asked her to be even more vulnerable than she already was and exposed. And Elisha knows what he's doing. I'm just looking at it from her perspective. She must have thought, this is too much. I can't do this. And again, if she had stayed there, and if she had walked away and said, "I'm just gonna say goodbye to my sons," she would have missed out on so much. She would have missed out on this miracle, this amazing miracle. Elisha then says, "Get your sons involved." And he sent her away to do this without his supervision. And yet, Elisha is telling her to take steps, one at a time, one foot in front of the other, to keep walking, to keep doing something. We talk about faith quite a lot in terms of how God loves us and he sent Jesus for us. We don't often think about it in missional terms enough, well, in my opinion, because it's one foot in front of the other. It's choosing to follow in faith. It's choosing to say, "This is radical. God, you want me to volunteer at Stage and Slam? I've never volunteered at Stage and Slam before. Is that what you want, God? But the kids, and they'll be so rowdy and stinky. Why not?" One foot in front of the other. I was asked to talk about mission a couple weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to share photos of my brother-in-law's feet. And I got so many comments based off of that story that I thought it would be worth bringing up again. My brother-in-law took mission so seriously that he says, "I'm not going to wear shoes, and I'm going to get gospel and peace tattooed on the top of my feet, so that when he's walking about with his no shoes, people look down and go, 'Hey man, what's up with the gospel and peace?'" He saw that from Ephesians chapter 6. He was so moved by the fact that God is challenging him to literally keep walking, to put one foot in front of the other for the purpose of mission, that that's what he did. He's got other tattoos too, and he's a bit weird. He's only got one eye. Interesting guy. Ask me about it later. I'll show you some photos. One foot in front of the other. Keep walking. We've got another story, and this one's quite long. Starting in verse 8. One day, Elisha went to Shunem, and a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. So whenever he came by, he stopped there to eat. She said to her husband, "I know that this man who often comes our way is a holy man of God. Let's make a small room on the roof and put in a bed and a table, a chair and a lamp for him. Then he can stay there whenever he comes to us." One day when Elisha came, he went up to his room and lay down there. He said to his servant, "Gehazi, call the Shunammite." So he called her, and she stood before him. Elisha said to him, "Tell her, you have gone to all this trouble for us. Now what can be done for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army?" She replied, "I have a home among my own people." "What can be done for her?" Elisha asked. Gehazi said, "Well, she has no son and her husband is old." Then Elisha said, "Call her." So he called her and she stood in the doorway. "About this time next year," Elisha said, "you will hold a son in your arms." "No, my lord," she objected. "Don't mislead your servant, O man of God." But the woman became pregnant. And the next year, about that same time, she gave a birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. So let's pause just for a moment. This is a very different situation. The other woman was desperate and needy and vulnerable. And this woman is a rich woman and a well-to-do woman. And she was important where she lived. And yet she had needs too. She had desires too. Just like the other woman, she had a situation that wasn't quite so dramatic and requiring immediate attention, but it mattered to her. And so Elisha is here with his pal, and they're trying to figure out what it is that they can do for this woman, because she's going to the trouble of making sure that he's welcome when he comes to town, that he's fed, that he's clothed, that he's looked after. So Elisha might be thinking, what can I even do for this woman that would bless her? And the fact that he wants to, I think, is revealing, because we've been saying it recently, God is a good father, and he gives good gifts to his children. And in the same way, Elisha's wanting to do the exact same. So it gets deeper. In verse 18, the child grew, and one day he went out to his father, who was with the reapers. My head, he said to his father. His father told a servant, "Carry him to his mother." After the servant had lifted him up and carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, then shut the door and went out. She called her husband and said, "Please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return." "Why go to him today?" he asked. "It's not the new moon or the Sabbath." "It's all right," she said. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, "Lead on, don't slow down for me unless I tell you." So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When he saw her in the distance, the man of God said to his servant Gehazi, "Look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, 'Are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your child all right?'" "Everything is all right," she said. So we're going to pause again. I think she was probably angry because she warned Elisha. She said, "Don't promise me something that it's not going to happen. It's just going to be taken away anyhow." And she has the means. She has a donkey. So she says to her husband, "Right, I'm going to see this guy, this man of God." And now imagine how she must be feeling. She wasn't vulnerable before. She wasn't exposed before. But now she's hurting. She's hurting terribly. And Elisha's already reached out and helped her, if you will. But she probably doesn't have that perspective. Her perspective is probably to be angry with Elisha and to go give him a what for. When she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet. Gehazi came over to push her away. But the man of God said, "Leave her alone. She is in bitter distress. But the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me why. Did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I tell you, don't raise my hopes?" Elisha said to Gehazi, "Tuck your cloak into your belt, take my staff in your hand, and run. If you meet anyone, do not greet him, and if anyone greets you, do not answer. Lay my staff on the boy's face." But the child's mother said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So he got up and followed her. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha and told him, "The boy has not awakened." One last pause. It didn't hit me until today that Gehazi is the one who's taking steps. He's the one who's obeying. I always thought Elisha was the sort of the main character in this, and maybe he is. I don't know. You could ask somebody more knowledgeable like John or Andy. But Gehazi has a choice to make. Gehazi is like, really? You want me to run? You want me to tuck in my cloak and run all this way to somewhere else? To lay a staff on a kid's face? Like, think about this. This is a different time. This is what, 2,800 years ago-ish? But people still were rational back then. They still would have been like, really? You want me to lay a staff on a kid's face? And he does it. And then he comes back defeated because it didn't work. When Elisha reached the house, there was the boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he got on the bed and lay upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. As he stretched himself out upon him, the boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room, and then got onto the bed and stretched out upon him once more. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite," and he did. When she came, he said, "Take your son." She came in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she shook her son. It's not very nice. She shook her son and went out. Took. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Maybe she did shake him. You never know. Took her son and went out. In this story, I still see action. I still see moving in one direction. I still see moving forward into the future in obedience. And Gehazi probably will be a bit frustrated that it was Elisha who came back and did this and was successful. But it's a lesson for him because he'll be watching and seeing that Elisha was also making choices. Elisha was the one who, again, he laid down on this boy, which is a weird thing to do, but he was willing to do it because he had that much trust and that much faith in his God that this is worth doing. This is gonna work. God's gonna do this. It's that faith that puts us on a path to begin with. So I resubmit to you. Is God saying to you, "Oh, do you know what? I've never been a part of Summer Buzz before. But I'm being invited to. I'm being invited to help out and to minister to kids. Mission in our own house. Summer Buzz is amazing. Stage Slam is amazing. But we need people to do it. Do you want for somebody else to do it? Or do you want to get involved? Do you want to start on that same path? Do you want to put one foot in front of the other and go, yeah, let's all start getting involved in mission? I think about the oil, I suppose, and she just had nothing. The widow, I mean, she just had virtually nothing except just a little bit of olive oil. And yet she had enough faith to do what she did. She had enough gumption and desire to see God work that she did. She walked over to the room where the oil was, and she walked over to her sons, and she walked around all these different houses to ask and beg people for jars. Can you imagine that happening now? What would that look like for you? Would that be walking around with leaflets for some of our summer mission? Would it be walking around for Big Idea? Big Alpha. Would it be walking around and inviting your friends and being vulnerable and exposed, just like this woman was? And yet, she died way before this ad campaign, but she would be thinking, keep walking. Keep walking. The funny thing about this clip, I believe that's Glencoe, and I suspect that's the West Highland Way. It looked like it. And you'll know yourself if you go on long walks. You get your feet torn up, and it hurts, and it costs. And you get, this is difficult. But did Jesus die on the cross and raise from the dead or not? I think I'm going to run out of time if I do this, but I think it's worth doing anyway. I'm just going to read this, and then we're going to sing a song about walking. I was thinking about this earlier because Paul... Paul in 1 Corinthians in chapter 15, he talks about the resurrection of the dead. He says, but if it's preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there's no resurrection of the dead? If there's no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Do we believe that Christ was raised from the dead? And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You're still in your sins. And those who have fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. Keep walking. John.